What's your favorite phase of matter? Liquids and solids are okay, I guess, but possibly not as exciting and mysterious as gases, the often invisible substances that fill our lungs and the universe itself. Best-selling author and material scientist Mark Miodovnik has written a new book called It's a Gas, the Sublime and Elusive Elements That Expand Our World. From their ancient associations with spirits and demons to their critical roles in modern science and technology, Mark unpacks the impact of gas on everything from the environment to technology. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
Hello, I'm Mark Miodovnik. I'm Professor of Materials and Society at UCL. I run a lab, I make materials, but I also write books and do radio series and TV series. And I want to tell you about my latest book, It's a Gas. And here are five key insights from that book. The first insight is that stuff matters. The stuff we make. Like, we are people who make stuff. I mean, that really is so obvious when you look around your home, your workplace, the cities. You know, we make a lot of stuff. And that stuff is a mirror of ourselves. Like, embedded in what we make and why we make it is who we are. And we kind of know that, really, because like that's why we have named the ages of civilization after materials. You have a Stone Age, you have a Copper Age, you have a Bronze Age. And the reason why we have those ages is because that every time we invent a new material, it changes everything. It changes how we live and how we interact with each other and what we build. And that changes who we are as humans. And so these needs for materials, they're not kind of these sort of luxuries. I mean, they are luxuries sometimes, but really they're a kind of obsession. They're kind of something that make humans very special, who we are. And at first, these materials, they embody our very basic needs. They need shelter. So we invent all sorts of building materials. First, it starts off with wood, and then we move on to stone and cities, so on, concrete. Then as we get more, you know, impressive in our ability to kind of transform the world into materials and structures and stuff, we start to embody our dreams and desires into them. So we end up building planes and spaceships, and we go to other planets, all because of our mastery of stuff. So this relationship between who we are and what we make, that's a key insight. And in my book, It's a Gas, I explore how the invention of gases and our discovery of what they are and what they can do for us. You know, how can they embody our dreams? And the dreams that really come out clearly in the development of gas technology are our dreams to travel. You know, we start off making boats and we harness the wind and we have these kind of incredible sailboats. And then we invent balloons like the one, you know, shown in the Olympics in Paris recently. And you wouldn't believe it, but the early balloons were hydrogen, right? A new gas, a very light gas. And it allowed these early explorers to explore the world from above. And everyone was in it. Like, if you had a party in the 16th, 17th century, you had hydrogen balloons and you had hot air balloons. And that was the way to kind of really signal the future. And of course, steam comes along, another gas technology. First, you get steam engines, then you get the steam railways. And the railways change everything about who gets to travel where. Like, it's a really democratic way. Before that, steam railways came along. Basically, most people, they grew up, they would never see the horizon, you know, the places beyond the horizon, really. They would never see the seaside. They would never see another country. I mean, a few people would go on boats and sailors and merchants, but most people were agricultural. Most people stood where they were because there was just no way to get there and back. And the steam just changed everything. So everyone got to travel. Everyone got to have holidays. And then everyone got to be these different people. And I guess that's the real point here, is that steam comes along and it changes who we are, not just a special few people, but everyone. And the bicycle comes along, it does the same thing. The car comes along, another gas technology, it does the same thing. It gives people independence, it gives them autonomy, it gives them freedom that they never dreamed of. And then, of course, the airplane and space travel, again, gas technologies and the spacesuits that you need to make real full use of them. They're all the way we've manipulated gases to make all that happen. That's all in the book. And it really is this incredible story of how we decide we want to do something. It's part of our dream to do it. It's a desire. And then we materialize it. And in this case, we had to kind of, in a way, the hardest challenge for humans, which is to master the invisible, to master these materials that almost all gases are invisible. You can't smell them, you can't feel them, you can't taste them, and yet they're incredibly powerful. And they have changed the way and who we are, this stuff. And we are now really, if you think about it, we're a migratory species now. Very few people are stationary. Almost everyone is moving, changing location on a daily basis. Some people fly on a weekly basis. You know, that's all because of gas technology. And it's been an incredible story, which I highlight in the book. The second key insight is that the act of making stuff, right? The act of actually going out and being part of the people who make stuff, that is really important. And it is about who we are. You might be tempted when you look at the modern world to think, okay, well, you know, the modern world is invented by these enormous corporations and they're very powerful and they've got trillion-dollar valuations and it's very lucrative and they give us, and we're grateful for this amazing technology. But that's not how it's happened, actually. That actually invention of the future, the materials that create who we are in the next 100 years, like what we're going to be doing, you know, what dreams are we going to fulfill? What needs are we going to fulfill? Those are developed by normal people in their workshops, inventing, tinkering, and often through accident. So in the book, it's really clear, like the sweep of thousands of years, the big technologies that have changed everything, often invented by some two or three people who just didn't say no. They just couldn't put up with the fact that they kept failing, but they would just keep going. I mean, the steam engine's a really good example of that. You know, it's one of our most important gas technologies, and still today. I mean, you might think it's historical, but actually 70% of global electricity is still made from steam engines. I uncover that in the book, like these invisible gases, which are hidden away in these places, creating the modern world. But, you know, that was invented by a preacher, someone who had very good mechanical skills, was an inventor by kind of nature, and wanted to solve the problem. The computer diode, which was the precursor to the computer chip, you know, that was an accident. It was a failed electric light bulb, that didn't light, but it had another use. And the people who can spot the fact that something that's an accident could actually be an insight into the future, those are the people who are living today. They might be your neighbor. They might be you. And in fact, that is keeping that spark alive, that invention spark alive in everyone, is really a big, important thing that has kind of marks out societies that are inventive and materially kind of rich. So the richness is not about how much stuff you have in your life. It's actually about how much stuff you get to make. And experiments and inventing, that's the DNA of everyone. And, you know, if you doubt me on this, you know, just think of people. You might think, well, I'm not someone with a workshop, but, you know, do you cook? Do you tinker in other ways? You know, do you garden? You know, actually that getting hands on stuff is really a very human thing. It's radical. It's revolutionary. And you really never know where it's going to lead you. It changes a lot of things in the politics of the world too. I mean, consider how carbon dioxide gas has gone from being this fizzy, lovely, strange material, right? Invented by Joseph Priestley, well, not invented, but discovered and kind of pumped into liquids to make fizzy drinks. And then in other ways, it was kind of understood by many different people. But as we've gone forward, now it's become our foe, right? Now it's become this big problem in the environment for us. And the person who invents a way to efficiently harvest it from the air will be a trillionaire. There's no doubt about that. And that's one of the big problems to solve, which we will solve, I'm absolutely sure. But the question is, who solves it? And I think the key insight from the book is it could be anyone, as long as we keep alive the importance of allowing people to make stuff in their homes, make stuff in the schools, make stuff in college and universities, in workshops, everywhere. And that brings me to my key insight 3, which is that making stuff does require access to kit. Like the more you kind of want to kind of extend your capabilities in making things, whether it be cooking, whether it be gardening or agriculture, or whether it be making a new technology in your workshop, the more you need access to really good tools. And actually, we've been losing that access over time. It's actually quite historically quite remarkable how there was a tools and people being part of the making wasn't part of everyday life for every generation pretty much before ours. You go back in time, my dad, my mom, sewing machines were all, you know, that was just normal. My dad tinkering with the car, the bicycle. I grew up in an era where everyone mended their stuff. Everyone did. It was just totally normal. And now if you look at modern homes, often they are built without a workshop, without anywhere that sort of, that mess can be made or tools can be stored. There are even some houses being made without kitchens now, which is, you know, extremely odd, right? Because that's a making space too, right? And this loss of access to making spaces is a potential problem for society. If we really want to kind of reach our hopes and dreams, solve our current problems and needs, we need a generation of people who grow up with access to that stuff, whether it's being in the home, in the school, whether it's being in a university, whether it's being in a technology firm or in a normal firm or cooking. One of the things that we have done here, I've been part of the invention of something called the Institute of Making. And I started it with my colleagues and friends, Zoe and Martin. And Zoe is an artist and Martin's a designer. I'm a material scientist and engineer. And what we realized is you need spaces in the modern world which are multidisciplinary. Like the stuff that we're making now and the tools and the way in which we work now is about pooling disciplines. So being an artist and being a painter, for instance, gives you just as much insight and right to be part of the making of the future as it does if you're a cook, a perfume maker. You might have, you know, you might be a sewer, you might be a clothes maker, you might be an electronics wizard. Those people all need to come together in the shared place if we're going to kind of take what is possible to the next generation. And you only have to look at the history, which I show in the book, of things like steam power again, where Watt, you know, there's a guy called James Watt, he really makes the steam engine a lot more efficient and he kind of pushes it a lot further forward. But it's only his friend Bolton, who's an economist and social scientist, who understands how you can take a steam engine and really harness it and make everyone realize that this is a game changer. Like, engines can be used everywhere. And he invents this idea of horsepower, where you basically measure how much power you get out of a steam engine, and you compare it to how much power you get from a horse. And you say to people like farmers, or you say to people like the army, look, you think you don't want a steam engine. You don't think a steam engine can be good for you. But look, I can compare how much more power you're going to get compared to how much you're currently using with your horses. And actually, we can make it cheaper and more efficient. And that there's a kind of magic there in that multidisciplinary, you know, coming together of people. And we need more of it. My fourth insight is that the power of gases are often a bit too alluring to resist, even when they're extremely dangerous. And we've seen this again and again in the history. So fire is the first gas technology, right? Now, the ancients thought fire was an element, a fundamental element of the universe, but it's not. It's a gas technology. And harnessing fire was one of the first technologies that really pushed us on as a species, of course. And, you know, it's actually attributed to the brain in humans being much larger because they could cook food using fire. This is our ancestors. And because cooking releases more calories, you can eat more, you have more free time to then do other things. And so fire is a key technology, but it's a gas technology. And it brought into the homes for the very reasons I just made clear in terms of heating and cooking. But it was also a threat. And it would burn the house down. So when the houses were made of wood or partly of wood or had roofs of hay and straw, of course, they got burnt down time after time. And whole cities were brought into destruction. It was also a weapon of war for that reason. And so it's always a double side to gases. And I think it's really interesting as you look at the kind of trajectory of the last few thousand years, as I show in the book, of how a new gas technology is kind of brought into being, it just releases so much, you know, new ways of living in the world. And but it also has a dark side. And the example of gas street lighting is a really good example of that. So early 1800s, almost all cities and towns are dark at night, and they're very dangerous places. They're places where you get mugged, you get murdered. They're incredibly dangerous places to move around. People wanted to have cities that were safer. And so there was a real push for street lighting. And the only thing that they could, you know, invent to do it was to harness methane and pipe it through the cities. And but that was just so dangerous. And it turned out to be smelly at the time. And Paris was the first one to have a go at it. They rejected it. London then had a go at it. And they succeeded. Londoners really took to it because it was dangerous and it kept leaking and there kept being explosions as it leaped out of these pipes. But it turned the city into a palace of light. And it's a palace of light we've never let go of. Even though electric light in the cities for street lighting is now electric, which was took 100 years later, actually that wonderful moment where you can have a city at night that's lit, that's a gas. That's what gas has brought to us. It's a true enlightenment moment. And we're still with it. Like, we still have methane pumped through all our cities. They still leak. There's not a week that goes by once you start tuning into it where there is not an enormous explosion in some big city in the world and whole buildings are brought into rubble. So we still can't quite let go of methane, even though we don't use it now for lighting. Generally, we use it for heating and for cooking. But there it is. And the word to gaslight someone, of course, has also stuck in our kind of cultural consciousness. The idea that, you know, you can say, look, this technology is great, it's great, it's great. And not also tell you about the downsides, or also kind of kid you that there's some other things going on. And that idea to gaslight someone is embedded in our culture. And, you know, we become very attuned to it. And as we go to the next big flammable gas that probably is going to be a big part of our economy, the hydrogen economy, we will have to kind of grapple with that thing where we want this future, which is driven by hydrogen, but it's very difficult. And hydrogen in particular is very difficult to control because the atoms are so small, the molecules are so small, that they actually travel through solid materials. The leaks are almost impossible to stop. So that was key insight 4. And key insight 5 is that, you know, these gases that we have got into our lives now, they have become our life support system. You only have to think of hot oxygen. You know, oxygen, we evolved on a planet, well, life evolved on this planet where there was no oxygen. There was none, almost none, trace amounts. And the early Earth did not look like a blue planet. If you had visited early Earth, you know, 4 billion years ago, it would have looked orange. And we would have been heading towards a destiny more like Mars. But actually, you know, life did keep here. We kept our atmosphere, albeit not oxygen-rich. And that was thanks to a magnetic field, which we kept hold of, which protected us from the winds of the sun. And life got a hold here. And then it started to harness oxygen. And as I show in the book, oxygen is an incredibly powerful molecule. And what it allows is multicellular life. It allows complex life to evolve. And if you see oxygen in a planet, or astrophysicists, that they see oxygen on the atmosphere of a planet, because it's so reactive, it won't stay around for long. It'll turn into rock. You know, we have silica rock, we have iron oxide, you know, these big rocks you see all around, you know, the surface of the Earth, that's because their oxygen, you know, they've reacted with oxygen. If oxygen's in there for any amount of concentration, then it's been produced probably by life. I mean, there's some new, really exciting evidence that there may be other ways to do it now. But these gases get more and more important to us. So think about oxygen. Think about going to hospital without it. Think about, it's impossible. Like, if you have paramedics carry it around with them, you know, you really have to have oxygen to get people, because you only have to be without breath for a minute and you're going to die. So oxygen's this liquor, this elixir. And it's also what allows us to go into space. You know, we have to be able to bottle it. We have to be able to produce it in space. We have to be able to do that on submarines. You know, in order to create these habitable places for us, you know, we have to turn them into mini Earths. And that control of oxygen, but not just oxygen, lots of other gases like nitrogen, has been the way in which we've sought to control our life support systems in hospitals, in you know, going to the moon, but also on this planet. And now we see carbon dioxide increasing, and you know, it's a threat. It's a threat because of the heating it creates. And what we seek to do is to control atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide. Now that is a big challenge, and that is about controlling the whole atmosphere and its gas content. So that's our ultimate life support system. And that's what we're trying to do. And if you think about that, really, that is godlike. You know, what we're attempting to be is godlike in our control of a whole planet and its atmosphere. And I'm not sure we're ready for that yet. And certainly it's going to be really interesting this century as you see our attempts to do that. Because can we control that power when we get it? And I'm pretty sure we will get it. Because if you look at the history of development of gases, which I show in the book, it is incredible. It's an incredible story. And there's so much more to happen. So yeah, those are my five key insights for the book. And I hope you enjoy reading it.
Thank you, Mark. That was Mark Miodovnik with five big ideas from It's a Gas, the sublime and elusive elements that expand our world. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.